Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 15. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This podcast is 2 days late and about $2 short. I've been sick and miserable as hell for the last few days, and I apologize for this going out late, but I'm still not better, and basically what happened is my stomach has gone out, and well, it's been a very rough time this last 4 or 5 days. Last week I went up to Oregon as well as Northern California, and I met Martin Ball and some of his friends and had a wonderful time with them. I also got a chance to stop by Professor John Rush's place and meet him in person and hang out at his place for a couple hours and see his garden and everything, which is quite impressive. And, of course, no trip to Northern California is complete without a stop by Jack Herer and Eddie Lepp's houses. So, of course, we had to go by there, and that is always most worthwhile. I'm going to keep this very short and quick today because I don't have a whole lot of energy to stay here and talk very long. I'm still trying to rebuild myself. John Rush, who is also an indie, has me on a new diet trying to figure this out. I've been working with various doctors for about 12 years on this stomach issue, so hopefully our dear Professor Rush will be able to get this one figured out. I sure hope so, and he sure seems to be on a better path than the other doctors I've been to in the past. Let's see, donations. Once again, Matthew has donated. This is probably the third or fourth time he's donated. I really appreciate it. And that was the only donation that we had this week. I do ask for donations each week. That is what keeps the show on the air and pays for the bills and everything, as well as the small book and DVD sales that we get from the Gnostic Media website. So if you could donate anything you can, large or small, we greatly appreciate it. And as I always mention, this is not corporate media. This is direct media brought to you by people like you, just trying to get alternative information out to the world. So your support is greatly appreciated. Astrotheology and Shamanism Publishing Issues, the second black and white edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism is in print. It is also available on the Amazon website as of yesterday, which was Monday. And let's see, the color edition has actually been held up in print. We had some color issues, some images turning up too red and things in the book, so that has been pulled from print temporarily while we get those issues resolved. The updated file was submitted already, so hopefully that's been corrected. I'll know in a couple days. So if you have gone to the Gnostic Media website and ordered a pre-order copy of the color edition or the second edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, please be aware that there is going to be a delay receiving your order on that, aside from what was already posted on the website. But It's getting there, and we're getting it resolved. So hang tight, and your order will come through. I still have copies available for the first 25 orders that come in for the pre-order on that. That will be coming with a free DVD. That will very much help support Gnostic Media if you would like to get one of those. And also, you can order the black and white combo deal from the website, from the Gnostic Media website, and that is ready to go. I'm expecting those from the printer any day now, and as soon as I have those, I will turn around and ship those immediately. And all this has really been a headache, so I apologize for any confusion, and thanks to those of you who've put in your pre-orders and for your patience. If you'd like to contact me directly, please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com, or you can go to the website www.gnosticmedia.com. You can also check out the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD there for free. Without further ado, I introduce Chris Bennett, who is the author of Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Marijuana in Magic and Religion. He's also the author of Sex, Drugs, Violence, and the Bible, which he co-authored with Neil McQueen. And he's the author of the upcoming book, Cannabis and the Soma Haoma Solutions. And it's a good show. It's not too long. It's under an hour. In fact, I don't think we've done a show under an hour since Professor Neil Whitehead came on. But hang tight. Here we go. Enjoy the show. I'm here with Chris Bennett, co-author of Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible with Chris, that came out wrong, with Neil McQueen. So how are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great.
Good to have you on the show.
Hey, pleasure to be here, Jan.
And so, you've written a couple of books already, or co-authored a couple of books, and you're working on, I assume, to be your third book now?
Yeah. That's right. It's called Cannabis and the Soma Haoma Solutions.
And being that we're both somewhat familiar with each other's research, I figured that there were a lot of directions that we could take this show. Did you want to start off with your current research, or would you like to go into older research and work forward? How did you want to do that?
Might as well start with the older stuff since you're more familiar with that stuff, you know?
Okay, well, you want to fire away with Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Marijuana and Magic and Religion that you co-authored with Lynn and Judy Osborne?
Yeah, that was a project that was completed in 1995, and I spent about 5 years working on that before I met up with Lynn and Judy for the last little bit of it. And it was basically a study of cannabis in a magical or religious context, mostly references from other material, different academics and writers writing on this type of thing, historical references and that type of stuff. And it looked at cannabis in a variety of cultures, ancient India, China, Africa, Mesopotamia, all around the world. And, noticed a number of commonalities with people that use cannabis for religious purposes, coming to the same conclusions about it being a spiritual food of sorts.
And, what was the primary conclusion that you were trying to reach with Green Gold, The Tree of Life?
Well, you know, it's funny because... although my research has, over the years, taken on a distinctly more of an anthropological approach, initially I had this religious experience reading the Book of Revelation and its passages about the Tree of Life 18 years ago. And that had led me into this area of research, trying to understand what had happened to me that night. And I thought, well, you know, if cannabis was the Tree of Life, as that occurred to me in this religious experience I had, then there'd be some evidence of it somewhere. Somebody else would have come across it, so I started looking for that, you know, and the accumulation of that material led to the book Green Gold, The Tree of Life, Marijuana, and Magic, and Religion.
Well, in your book, you also talk about mushrooms. I noticed that you have a very rare image from an image called Roasting the, what is it called here? I'm just looking.
Roasting a Salamander. I don't know what the name of the title of the book is, because years ago that I got that. But yeah, it's basically a picture of an alchemist tripping on mushrooms, and has to do with roasting a salamander. And Rabelais as well makes a reference to the fly agaric in a paragraph where he mentions the roasting of the salamander, an alchemical act as well. Possibly it may have been due to the slimy skin, spotted skin of a salamander. There was some comparison there between that and the agaric. But yeah, after I was researching green gold, I found, that the role of the shamanic use of plants in religion is really the indication of the birth of religion. That's where it all started with, and soon learned that cannabis was not alone as a religious sacrament, that a variety of plants, mushrooms, cacti, have been used in different areas of the world became pretty clear.
I've found some other interesting symbolism in Christian iconography that also shows the salamander, and I think one of them was the Aberdeen Bestiary out of England, and it also had mushroom trees depicted. So I wonder if more if the salamander isn't related to the serpent, which that we argue is possibly related to the caduceus and by that extension drugs.
Yeah, well, possibly. In the Persian Avestan version of the whole Eden myth, and the origins of the Haum and Soma, it's actually a lizard that is there, not a serpent. So it may be even related to that in some way.
Yeah, it very well could be. And then your last book was called Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible that you co-authored with Neil McQueen. Would you like to talk about that book?
Yeah, that book, when I was researching green gold, I came across the work of anthropologists working in the 30s, and again, a published article in the 70s, Sula Bennett, also known as Sarah Bennett-Tawa, who said there were these Hebrew references to cannabis under this name, cannabossum. And Bennett, no relation to me, showed this by tracing the modern word cannabis back through history, as well as looking at similar terms in surrounding cultures like Mesopotamia, where they were using it under the name of Cannaba right around the same time that the Hebrew references were recorded. And I took a look at this in Green Gold briefly, but I didn't really have a major background in the Bible. I didn't understand the whole historical context of the Bible and things like that. So after I finished Green Gold, I decided to explore that more so in the context of the biblical storyline, and I got together with a friend of mine, Neil McQueen, who had a degree in religious studies with a focus on the Bible, and together we decided to take a look at these references that Sula Bennett pointed out to, five distinct references, one in Exodus, one in Song of Songs, one in Ezekiel, one in Jeremiah, and one in Isaiah. And look at those because they kind of conflicted. In the first of these references in Exodus 30:23, Moses, who of course first meets the angel of the Lord in flames of fire from within a burning bush, is commanded to make a holy anointing oil with about 6 to 6.5 to 9 pounds of cannabossum, depending on how much you consider the weight of the shekel, with myrrh and cinnamon, mixed into about 1.5 gallons of olive oil. And every time that Moses is to speak to the Lord on behalf of the Israelites, and it should be noted that none of the other Israelites ever see or hear the Lord. They can just tell if Moses is speaking to the Lord by looking over at the tent of the meeting, and if the pillar of smoke is pouring out of the tent of the meeting, then Moses is in there speaking to the Lord. Now, the commandments in Exodus 30:23 command that only the high priest should be allowed to use this holy oil, or anybody else who made it or used it would be cut off from their people, which was paramount to a death sentence in the ancient world. And every time Moses would go in, he'd seek advice from the Lord on behalf of the Israelites over whatever problem they were facing. He would go into the tent of the meeting and he would cover himself in this oil. And THC is fatty soluble, and your skin's a big organ. And things like myrrh and cinnamon increase blood flow. So this would have increased the potential penetration of THC into the skin. But this wasn't the only thing that was done. The oil was placed on the altar of incense as well, which was lit. And Moses, in fact, spoke to the Lord in the, or at least in the storyline, you know, I don't know how much facts in here. Moses spoke to the Lord in the pillar of smoke over the altar of incense. The altar of incense, the pillar of smoke is actually referred to as the Shekinah in Hebrew. It actually means the physical presence of God. And so when you throw cannabis into a scenario like this, it becomes an act of shamanism. You know, it becomes, was Moses in there speaking to the Lord in a pillar of smoke, or was Moses like a shaman from, you know, as we know, cross-culturally ingests a psychoactive plant and then interprets the events that ensue from the effects of that psychoactive plant as some sort of divine conversation.
Have you had a chance to check out Professor John Rush's new book, Failed God?
Just what you sent me, you know, and I think he's quite mistaken in his view on Calamus, and for obvious reasons, which I stated in my own book, which I don't think he thoroughly read. The references to cannabosum in the Bible clearly refer to it as coming from a foreign land. And Calamus grows all over Israel. It's not a foreign substance and stuff like that. In Ezekiel, it's coming in on a caravan of trade. And Jeremiah, the prophet, condemns the use of cannabis in Jeremiah 6:20, saying, having the Lord say through his mouth, what do I care for this cannabis from a different land? So, from a distant land. So it's clearly identified as an ivy trade, and that's a big thing about the term cannabosum. It comes from an Indo-European root for cannabis. And what happened is, as cannabis use spread around the ancient world, likely through the trade networks of the ancient Scythians in Indo-European culture, it carried the name of its origins with it as an item of trade, as opposed to coming up with its own name in each individual area, as happens with things like water and dirt and things like that.
Talk a little bit about your new book. You just mentioned that. What are your new discoveries? Well, where are you going with it, and what's the goal?
Well, initially I planned on just doing a little booklet on cannabis in the ancient world, based around a number of articles I've written for different magazines over the years and earlier research in Green Gold and stuff like that. And I planned on, you know, doing like a 100-page type thing, something easy to read and cheap to publish and whatnot. And I thought I would update it with a little bit more current information, you know. And, you know, at the time I wrote Green Gold, there wasn't a thing like the Internet available, you know. So as I began to update it, looking around for information, in the ensuing decade and a half or close to it, there's just been a wealth of not only new information, but information that suddenly became accessible to me that I no way had access to before. And it just started piling in. And what happened, as I was researching that, I was doing a chapter on cannabis in India and also Persia and places like that. And I had I dealt with the subject of soma and heoma in previous works, both in Green Gold in 1995 and Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible 2001, and then in an article for Cannabis Culture, I think in 2006. And in 2006, and initially I was less convinced about identifying cannabis with soma. For one thing, R. Gordon Wasson's theory on the fly agaric being the soma had become so pervasive that it was hard to even suggest it was anything else without having anybody bring that up, and I just took it for granted that there must be a lot more to it. So I always kind of just left it wide open in other books, saying that, you know, might be the fly agaric, might be cannabis, could be a composite name for a number of plants. But then in 2006, when I was researching the article for Cannabis Culture magazine, I had found that in the 90s, a Russian archaeologist, Victor Serianati, working in the Bactria Margiana region, which is near Afghanistan, had found a 4,000-year-old temple, which he claimed was a Soma temple, including pots and things, strainers and different items used for the preparation of the Soma. And at this site, he claimed to have found remnants of cannabis and ephedra, as well as poppy in later cases. And so this kind of opened up the whole question, you know, of it. And so I started looking at that and writing with that, and then started collecting information more, trying to back that up, because there was some debate about it. Some people said what Sari and Natty had said were cannabis seeds were in fact millet seeds. So I was able to show, you know, and find other sources that showed that that wasn't the case, that they were in fact cannabis seeds based on the shape and whatnot. And then other people said the THC tests that they performed on the material were flawed as well, while other people disagree. So Serenati's find, although compelling and interesting, was in debate and wasn't enough to show the situation. So I started collecting more information on that. And basically, you know, found things like the 5th century B.C. text, Sapatha Brahma, which refers quite explicitly to Soma being Usana, the plant Usana, which is consecrated and made Soma in rites. And Usana is a Sanskrit term for cannabis. Usana is the actual Sanskrit term, but U is a prefix that was used at the time the Sapatha Brahma was composed. So we have a direct reference from 500 BC, although not part of the Vedas, it's still a Vedic text, saying specifically that, that this was the plant that cannabis was made from. And so then, if that's the case, all of a sudden this creates a situation where, okay, so if cannabis was Soma in India, and they still use cannabis in India, but they somehow forgot what Soma was, how did that come about, right? And in India, the answer to that situation is, for one thing, in the Sapatha Brahma, it's not that cannabis is Soma, it's that cannabis is consecrated and made Soma. That left it wide open to consecrate a variety of plants as Soma, just based on that passage alone. But what happens is, initially, at the time of Buddha, who was a major influence on Hinduism, if a Hindu refuses to eat meat, it's because of the laws laid down by Buddha. It wasn't in Hinduism prior to Buddha. And if a Hindu man or woman chooses not to drink alcohol, it's also from the influence of Buddha on Hinduism, because prior to that, alcohol was widely used in India. And these prohibitions were fairly successful. So it was a strong focus on the outlawing of intoxicants. Also, at that time, the Brahmins, the caste of the Brahmin, were largely in charge of the ritual life of India. And everything, you know, the daily life was requiring all these rituals and sacrifices, much of which involved the partaking of Soma as well. And this was complicated for people and was causing a lot of resentment. There wasn't, in the early period, there wasn't yet an indigenous agricultural cannabis crop, and a lot of it had to be imported from where they'd come from before and whatnot, and was costing a lot of money. It was heavily taxed, and people really began to resent the Soma sellers and Soma purveyors. And so initially, with not really violent prohibitions or anything like that, and still by Buddha, more persuasive and culturally pushed, but gently pushed, an initial move kind of moved in to kind of separate the mass of ritual life and control that the Brahmins held over the people. And then this was further enhanced by the laws of Manu, also known as the Code of Manu or the Book of Manu, which is thought to be composed sometime between the 2nd century BC and 2nd century AD, although some sources put it earlier, as early as 1200, but that doesn't seem likely to be the case, where it's explicitly prohibited along with alcohol. So, and what happens is Brahmins are forbidden from selling Soma. If you give food to a seller of Soma, it becomes his excrement according to the laws of Manu. A variety of prohibitions are placed over Soma. And if a Brahmin is selling Soma or done anything like that, he can lose his caste, his role in society,
Chris,
and be made into almost like a, yep.
Let me ask you this. Aren't you the one who sort of brought out the research on the prohibitions beginning with Deuteronomy and the Book of Law in your book, Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible?
Well, I couldn't lay claim to bring him out, maybe to the cannabis world,
Well, I mean, as far as being part of the Pharmacratic Inquisition, I think, and as far as many of the books that I've read in that regard, you were the only one that I had found.
But scholars are aware of the later date of the Book of Deuteronomy and how it relates to temple worship and stuff like that. So I just mean I can't take credit for that part of it, but for tying it in with the drug prohibition, that's completely true as well.
Well, I think that that's an interesting correlation between what you're saying with the Brahmins.
Yeah, it is. Well, and this happens with Zoroastrianism, and what I really learned about the prohibition in Zoroastrianism and Zoroaster's rallying against the Hamlet cult, how completely intertwined this is with the discovery of the Book of the Law, Deuteronomy, in the Old Testament, and how the fabrication of the Book of the Law is completely interwound with Zoroaster's prohibitions against Hamlet. And what the situation there is in Persia, where I don't know, I assume most of your readers are kind of up to date on the history that we're dealing with, so if they get lost behind, maybe they'll have to do some googling around. But in India, we're dealing with Soma, but in Persia, we're dealing with the same plant drink, or at least originated with the same plant drink, but it's known as Haoma. And Zoroaster was a monotheistic reformer who was dealing with pantheon, much like which is in India, with all the different gods and goddesses and stuff like that. And he took one of the gods from that pantheon, Ahura Mazda, and raised it to a pivotal point of, soul kind of monotheism with some little angels and stuff like that around. And this became the religion of the Persian Empire through Darius. And it's believed that Darius's father, Vishtaspa, also known as Hystaspes, was actually initiated by Zoroaster with cannabis. And Darius converted the Persian Empire over to the Zoroastrian religion. And this is all occurring right around the same time, about 100 years before Darius, Israel and Judah had fallen to Assyria and Babylon, and they'd taken the ruling class from Israel and placed them in other areas of the world and left the people there kind of without rulers and without control and instilled their own rulers in there. Well, the Persians decided to send a lot of the ruling class or the descendants of the ruling class back to their homeland. And they did this all over the place, but one of the things they did was when they were instilling the ruling class back in their homeland is they picked a deity from the various pantheons. And it seems completely likely to me that prior to this period in Israel, we're dealing with the basic Canaanite polytheistic pantheon, not any sort of monotheism before this period. And I'm talking 5th, 6th century B.C. If there was a Moses prior to this time, any sort of monotheistic creed he tried to lay down certainly didn't stick, because even in the Old Testament accounts of Kings and Chronicles, there's only two kings out of all the kings who are monotheistic kings. The rest of them are depicted purely as polytheistic worshippers of kings, of gods and goddesses and different things. And so what happens when the Persians under Darius start sending these people back? Nehemiah and Ezra are sent back, and this is the whole period where the monotheism sticks down, and it's likely that they came there. What the deal was is that by unifying the worship into one temple and get rid of the competing deities, is basically what the Book of the Law, Deuteronomy, does, they are able to consolidate the worship and therefore the giving of tithes and money and whatnot, gold, into one area, which is much easier to control. And it's also religious groups are almost like political parties in this age and period as well, right? And so the monotheism that was sent back in the building of the temple was sent back. They could do that, and they could have their sort of independence as long as all the tithes and all the money went back to their Persian overlords through the temple of Yahweh, which was like the Semitic version of Ahura Mazda, the Persian god.
Do you think there's any correlation between the wordplay of Brahma and Abraham?
You know, there may well be. I've read that type of stuff. I know that you know, certain treaties, like the Treaty of Mitanni, written in about the 14th century BC, makes reference to a number of Vedic gods. So, you know, the Vedic gods were all popular, you know, and being worshipped in the Middle East. You know what I mean? It's clearly the case. But I just don't know really enough about that particular situation to comment on it. I wouldn't really be surprised, you know. Abraham, you know, the account of Abraham almost seems like a prequel to the whole Mosaic thing, in the sense that Abraham and his wife Sarah go through much of the trials and tribulations that the Israelites were supposed to have gone through as a people. And, you know, there's all this stuff. You know, I'd say, like, things like the stories of the patriarchs in the Bible are a hodgepodge of ancestral tales combined with a mythologicized background trying to endorse the monotheistic takeover of the Holy Land, you know?
Right.
So it's kind of a combination of little bits of fact, lots of fiction.
And need I remind the listener that Abraham received the oracle underneath the oak tree, which is a host of various types of Amanita mushrooms.
Yeah, well, I think the manna thing in the Old Testament is probably the most compelling piece of mushroom evidence, you know? It's pretty clearly the life of a mushroom there with a whole manna thing, as you well know.
Have you seen the new evidence that I just published in the Holy Mushroom from the Epistle to the Renegade Bishops?
No, I haven't. I hope to take a look at it sometime here as soon as I'm finished doing all this cannabis research in the next couple of months. But
yeah,
I haven't really diverged too much.
Just very briefly, it's basically this... This guy writing from a monastery on the Mount Athos Peninsula, discussing how the holy mushroom rose up out of the table in the center of the monastery and stopped the Roman invaders, the Roman Catholics, from taking over the monastery, and all of the multitudes were healed by the mere possibility of tasting the holy mushroom. And then it goes on to state how the miracle of the holy mushroom was announced to all of Christianity at the time.
What year is this in?
This was published in, it was written in the late 1500s, and was, the copy that I have was found in the Ukraine, but it is known that it was sent out very broadly to pretty much all of the monasteries and cathedrals, etc., at the time.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What's the word they translate, like, what for mushroom from that period?
We've been trying to get the original translator of the document is Harvey Goldblatt from Yale University, and it was published by in a journal called Harvard Ukrainian Studies, obviously by Harvard University. And we've been trying to get a hold of the original document, but getting Professor Goldblatt to reply on something that's obviously going to blow up in his own face, as not that it's really probably going to be avoidable in the long run, but he just hasn't been, he hasn't replied to any of my inquiries directly.
You know, that's been an ongoing theme that I see, is academic reluctance to explore the role of psychoactives in existing religions, in the history of existing religions.
You know, since I've started this podcast, I've found an amazing number of, a startling number of academics who seem to have been wanting to talk about this for a long time, but until I started bringing other academics together willing to talk about it, they were sort of reluctant. But once one stuck his neck out, it seems like all the others are much more willing to follow.
well, hopefully a trend started, and that would be good. You know, there have been some, like Professor Rock and different people like that, Richard Evan Schultes and Albert Hoffman and whatnot, but the majority certainly don't favor it, and university students who try to present master's and PhD theses on these subjects often receive minimal marks.
Right. Well, you're obviously aware of Professor John Rush's book, Failed God, that argues that Jesus was, in fact, the mushroom, as John Allegro argued. And then Professor Carl Ruck, I went to his home in April and did an interview with him there. And he told me that next year he is also planning to publish a book substantiating Allegro's work, and that... He's actually been in great support of Allegro for some time, but until, you know, other people started coming out about it, I guess he just felt it better not to bring it up. He didn't want to be the only one. So I've also seen some interest out of other professors since these, you know, my book and the other others have started coming out. Really showing an interest to bring this into the academic journals and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. You know,
yeah, definitely.
There is one other question I wanted to ask you. Have you read Shamanism and Tantra in the Himalayas by Christian Ratch and his wife?
I haven't. I've read a lot of Christian stuff, and he's a great researcher, but I haven't had a chance to read that yet.
In his book, I don't remember the page number. I have it cited in Astrotheology and Shamanism, but in there he talks about 108 plants, psychoactive plants, being dedicated to Shiva. What do you think about that?
Well, it seems like I'd have to see the list, I suppose, but being dedicated to Shiva, all sorts of stuff, you know, is dedicated to Shiva, as datures, henbane, cannabis. And 108 seems like I can't even think of 108 psychoactive plants myself.
I've got Christian
Ratch's. I don't know.
I've got his massive encyclopedia here on the shelf. I'm sure we can find 108
there. Oh, it's great. Yeah, I'm sure we can find 108 there for sure. No, it's a great resource piece. I think that's probably the best on the subject so far, his encyclopedia of psychoactive substances.
What do you think of David Spess's book, Soma?
Is this the one where it talks about the blue lotus?
Yeah, blue the lotus and lily flowers, but I'm not sure.
I haven't read it, but I find it pretty unlikely from what I know about both of them.
You know, one thing that I talked to him after I read his book on the phone, and he said that he had also argued for the mushroom in the book, but the editors had gone through and chopped out all mention of the book, and that the original manuscript was like 700 or 900 pages, and they would only print 150 pages of the original or something like that.
Yeah, well, you know, sex, drugs, violence in the Bible is twice as big as well. That's the unfortunate reality of the cost of printing, as you know, I'm sure. But yeah, I don't know. I've only just glanced at that book, and I didn't get the impression that it had the academic rigor of some other material out there. You know, but I could be wrong. I have, like I said, I just glanced at it.
So, what other exciting tidbits do you have from your new book?
Well, I think that, like on the cannabis soma subject, a really interesting thing is the recent discovery of Caucasian Aryan mummies in China, dating from 200 to 2000 BC. And this raises some interesting etymological arguments put forth by Manda Hassan a good decade and a half to 2 decades before the discovery of these mummies. Manda Hassan was saying there was an etymological connection between Chinese hu ma, cannabis, huang ma, ephedra, and heoma, the Persian word for soma. And this is really interesting because there's a lot of, like, if you take a look at the whole Taoist tradition of cannabis in China, starting around 200-300 BC and carrying on for quite some time, there really is a lot of similarities between cannabis and soma in the Vedic and Chinese things. In the Taoist tradition, cannabis is one of the superior elixirs of immortality. And in the Vedic and Persian tradition, the soma, heoma are considered to be elixirs of immortality. It's also a major medicine in the Chinese literature. Same with soma and heoma, were both medicinal and spiritual plants. They both came from, you know, holy mountains full of immortal figures. There's just a whole whack of it. And the idea is what's happening with these white mummies that they found in China is that two different graves, they found cannabis. In one of them, there was over 2 pounds of cannabis that was so well preserved, you could still see the trichomes and you could probably grow the seeds and stuff like that. That was 2,700 years old. There's no evidence of any sort of like burning of it or smoking of cannabis, so they're assuming that it was made into a drink or a food or something like that. And interestingly, there were bundles of ephedra at some of these grave sites as well, which brings up the whole Bactria Margiana complex, where this temple was that I referred to earlier was discovered, where they found that soma was being prepared from cannabis and ephedra. And this is interesting, too, because the Chinese words for ephedra and cannabis are so close, they're thought to have originated from the same source. I'm starting to take the view that this is where the soma cult originated. This is right up around the Tian Shan Mountains, which was thought to be the birthplace of cultivated cannabis. And the cannabis that they found in the Tirin Basin with these white mummies was cultivated for drug purposes. It wasn't cultivated for industrial, you know, hemp purposes, for fiber purposes. This was specifically for drug content that this particular strain of cannabis had been growing. So obviously they've been doing it for some time to take it to that point where they, you know, had specified a drug producing plant. And so this seems to be like what they're finding after doing DNA analysis of some of these mummies. And it should be noted that these mummies are very hard to access or research because it's really throwing a big threat to Chinese history. China likes to think of themselves as a country and a nation that has developed independent of Caucasian, African, and other races of humanity, almost as a distinct species. There used to be a skull around Peking Man, and that was kind of like their Neanderthal skull. You know, they figured that was who they descended from, was Peking Man, and that descent was not the same as what Western man descended from. And they like to think that things like chariots, horse riding, bronze making, all these things were developed independently in China by Oriental natives of China. And what these mummies have done is they've changed all that because these people came in as horseback riders. They were connected with the Scythians, who you're probably familiar with. They originated along the Russian steppes near Ukraine, places like that, and were known, say, like around 3500 BC as the Sheridani Stog. And sometime before that, they'd started the art of horseback riding and the taming of horses. And this is also the area of the world where we have the oldest evidence of cannabis being used for intoxicating purposes. There's evidence of a cannabis brazier from 3500 BC in Ukraine, and so it shows that these people were burning cannabis 5,500 years ago. These individuals went up into China and also west into Western Europe, becoming the Celts and the Druids, but a group of them went up into China, got cut off from other people for a while, started developing their own independent culture, came into contact with the Oriental Chinese, and this whole thing with heoma, soma, became about, and the formerly the intoxicant that was formerly burnt in braziers came to be consumed in a drink in this area, and then this act was exported via Bactria Margiana into Persia, and then later into India, and DNA tests of these individuals in China, show DNA from India, from Western Europe, from Eastern Europe, from all over Asia. So they were like a mix-match group of people, and the discovery has completely altered the perceptions of trade in the ancient world. Prior to this, it was thought that the Silk Road didn't open up till about 135 BC, but now they're placing this at up to 1,000 to 2,000 years prior to this. And it's interesting because in Egypt, in one of the mummies from 1200 BC, they found a strand of silk in his hair from China. So this indicates that even in Egypt, this was part of this massive trade network throughout the ancient world connecting it. And cannabis was a major commodity of trade, and it was likely through the same trade route that people like the Israelites came into contact with it.
I think, personally, that symbols such as the caduceus found on so many ancient coins is strong evidence that drugs like cannabis and many others were traded as heavy commodities. In fact,
I think they're the most valuable.
Right, and not
you know,
only
they say even incense was worth more than gold.
Well, not only that, but the word merchandise comes from I've found etymological evidence that the word merchandise comes from the root mercury, and obviously the mercury is the bearer of the caduceus.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it's completely clear that these were major items of trade, major sought-after things. These were what people wanted and sought after and were willing to trade for and whatnot, you know. And clearly in India as well, that it was part of this trade network, and massive taxes were placed on the importation of soma as a result.
You've also done your own research into the history of fertility cults and psychoactive drug use there as well. Would you mind talking about that?
Well, this is intertwined with the soma cult as well. I basically see that agriculture likely started with cannabis use. And ancient man, as they began to suss out the world around them, often incorporated symbolic magic into their lives. So if they wanted the male and female cannabis plants to pollinate, then by having sex, that would ensure that, you know what I mean? And so there was a massive fertility ritual around the propagation of cannabis. And this is intertwined also even with the harvesting of it. You know, it was likened to the life cycle of humanity on a microcosmic scale. And they thought that by practicing a fertile sexual life, that they were ensuring the fertility of the world around them, whether it be, groups of people performing this, or whether it be, say, like still takes place in the Jagannath Festival in India, it be simply relegated to the act of a priest and priestess, or a king and a queen, or things like that. There's evidence of this all over the ancient world. The Tammuz Ishtar poems, all these types of things are part of this ancient fertility ritualistic cult. And this orgiastic ritualization was hard for the monotheistic reformers to deal with. It was so popular. And probably much of the root taboos about sexuality we see in the Bible, prohibitions of different sexuality, likely came about due to the massive venereal disease problem that was created by this indiscriminate sexuality, which sometimes included wild beasts like donkeys and bulls who were celebrated for their fertility due to the massive sizes of their phalluses and whatnot.
I've even got a picture of an ancient Hindu carving that is that shows a Hindu god having sex with a horse.
Yeah, that's the type of thing that was happening. Exactly. Yeah, there's similar type of stuff in Middle Eastern iconography as well, and it's pretty clear that the horse and donkey show of Tijuana has its predefined in ancient Near East as well.
um, What effects do you think your particular research will have on the entheogenic community as far as upcoming studies and publications are concerned? What have you found that's, and how is it going to, if, what or what has,
Well, I
you understand what I mean.
yeah, I understand what you're saying. Well, I think, like I don't want to come across as arrogant or egotistical or anything like that, but I think I've put forth the most solid case for the history of soma and how it came to be lost and the role of it and how substitutes came into play and that type of thing to date. And I've tried to, like, one of the things I noticed when I read Wasson's book was how completely easy it was to poke holes in his ideas and theories and rip it apart. And I've tried to present my own work in a way that answers those type of things before somebody can bring it up. So I think it will have, maybe not an immediate effect, and although I'd love that, I think it will have a long-lasting effect. And it will stand the test of criticism.
How do you think your research compares to that of Clark Heinrich's in regards to soma?
I think I make a better case, I found a lot of Heinrich's book, which I read quite some time ago. I haven't read all of his books. I read one of them.
I think he's
Forbidden
got
Fruit
two,
or
I think he's got two, but they're both the same book. One is a first edition, the other is a second.
Okay, they got different titles?
Yes.
Or the same title?
One is
Yeah. I read the first edition.
okay.
Yeah, I read the first one. And it seemed to me like a lot of his argument, like Watson's, was based on kind of like symbolism, of the bowl and things like that. A big problem with Watson's book, who I've read more recently and more thoroughly, was that, and this is what I recall from Heinrich's, is that one thing about soma is, okay, soma is a plant, it's a beverage, and it's a god, and it's the moon in the sky. And a lot of times these guys are pointing to references. When you become familiar with the Vedic literature and all the mandalas, and you read them in the context of the way they're written, a lot of times these researchers have made references trying to build a case for the mushroom based on soma as a bowl or soma as the moon, and it's clearly talking about, in a lot of cases, soma as the moon. Like Watson refers to the pillar of the sky, in reference to soma, and says this represents the fly agaric mushroom. But the pillar of the sky is the moon, and the moon symbolized the celestial cup of soma from which the gods drank. And as it waned, that was the draining of the soma cup. And as the sun, Agni, the fire god, replenished it was refueled, you know what I mean? And this life cycle was kind of imitated on Earth as well.
What do you think about the polar axis, the World Tree theme being a possible scenario for the same
Yeah.
concept?
Yeah, well, that's like it's a pretty ancient one, I didn't really, I haven't really delved into the whole Yggdrasil or whatever it is, the World Tree thing, all that much myself. I don't know, I just, I don't know. I didn't get the impression from anything that Watson has written about it that there was too much there. But there's like some interesting things, like I'm making these blanket statements, but it's pretty clear that for large periods of time that soma was a term that referred to all sorts of different plants. You know what I mean?
Right.
And the same thing could be said about bang. The same thing could be said about the term bang, which is generally considered to be cannabis, like the Russian term for the mushroom, panga, is directly related to Persian banga, meaning cannabis, you know what I mean? And, throughout the whole medieval period, the term bang in the Middle East could mean henbane, datura, cannabis, and probably even mushrooms there as well. There's a really good chance that that's the case. And so, it's not always as easy as cut and dry type of situation with some of this etymological research. You know, there's different periods of time where different things come to mean different things, you know?
Yeah, I do, and I totally agree with you on the change in the different formations and drugs and things like that in its many forms as well. There was a point
that's what's so nice about something like... Oh, sorry, I just wanted to say that was what's so nice about discoveries like that was in China, where it's like solid archaeological... Here's the marijuana, you know what I mean? It's not based on some... textual interpretation or etymological assumptions or anything like that. It's solid stuff that's right there, you know what I mean? And that's ideally the best type of stuff we can get. Everything else is, you know, contextual, you know, hypothetical thoughts, basically.
And, you know, which is... what's been very nice about finding this Epistle to the Renegade Bishops document that talks about the holy mushroom is because, you know, now we have solid textual evidence of the holy mushroom, and it's no, you know, it's no longer speculation and looking at only the iconography and saying, look at all these hundreds of mushroom trees and mushrooms, they've got to be taking them. But now we have a document that says not only... Did they have knowledge of the mushrooms? But now we can go back and look at all of the iconography and have a whole new meaning of it. And I think, you know, cannabis, I've certainly found evidence of cannabis use. I've found evidence of Datura and henbane use. Obviously, the mandrake is mentioned in the Book of Genesis with Leia and her sister. Rachel,
yep.
Arguing over the
mandrake.
When I actually had a Sumerian and biblical philologist look into that to see if the connection there was actually to the drinking of soma rather than the purchase, because the word is almost identical. It's like one letter change difference between consuming versus purchasing or trading the mandrake for this.
Right, and if that letter was a vowel, then it's like not even one letter, because they didn't have vowels in that period of time in the Hebrew language.
Right. And you know, so my friend, she looked up every ancient biblical text and translation that she could find, and she couldn't see any alteration that would support my concept there. But you know, it would be nice if, or not nice, it would be, I wouldn't be surprised, I should say, if one day something did pop up that would show that they were using the mandrake for that specific reason as well. So, just a lot of interesting correlations between the many different plants that are being used in all of the various religions. And regarding Gordon Wasson, you had mentioned poking holes in his research, and I found in my own book, my last book that I published, The Holy Mushroom, that was the case with all of Wasson's, which is very limited, all of his research into Judeo-Christianity, and that basically what Wasson had done was created sort of a false barrier surrounding 1000 BCE and the Book of Genesis, which is a date that's off by 414 years at
least.
And had created this bogus story around it using Panofsky's interpretation of the mushroom tree. And basically Panofsky had just said that, well, it's a common theme in Christianity, so therefore it couldn't be a mushroom. It's just copied. And so without actually doing a study and comparing these mushroom trees and looking more into them, Wasson accepted Panofsky's argument and then, you know, enforced it on other scholars like John Ramsbottom at the London Botanical Museum. And then when Allegro came up, and Allegro published Wasson's own letter to John Ramsbottom where Wasson says, rightly or wrongly, he's going to reject the plain coral fresco as a mushroom. So, you know, Wasson, I have found in many places created very poorly put together arguments that have been accepted as fact and sort of distributed as the golden rule. And what we found in investigating all of his claims against Allegro is that he had actually made up all of them. We meaning myself and John Allegro's daughter, checked all of the claims that Wasson made against Allegro, and including those made by Jonathan Ott against the research, and none of them panned out.
You know, I found Wasson writes for an agenda, not for fact. And that he completely ignores anything that disagrees with his view. He shuts it out of the argument, doesn't include it.
I would agree with that. And are you aware that when Wasson was working with J.P. Morgan, he was the direct investor for the Vatican and held many private sessions with the Pope?
You know, most of this type of stuff I'm learning about Wasson, honestly, Jan, I'm learning from you, to tell you the truth.
Actually, that was published in... That was originally published in Thomas Reidlinger's book, The Sacred Mushroom Seeker.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. He obviously was pretty close to the Vatican if he was able to work in that capacity with them.
What else would you like to add to the show? Did you have any other things you would like to focus on before we start to say goodbye?
I can't really think of anything. We covered a lot of ground, I guess. There's always topics of interest out there. I'm going to be expert witness in a religious use of cannabis court case here in Canada, in the eastern province of Ontario, and Professor Carl Ruck will be expert witness at the same court case. That should be pretty interesting. It's involving the Church of the Universe, a church I've been involved with for about 18 years, which recognizes cannabis as the tree of life, and you know, has the potential of making some change in the law, you know, with Professor Ruck and whatnot there. So hopefully that all pans out. If people want to find out more about my writing and research and whatnot, they can check out my website, forbiddenfruitpublishing.com. And there's different articles that I've had published, as well as videos, documentaries, news stories, interviews, and whatnot that I've been in. And they can find out a lot more about what I've done and what I'm doing in there. And as well, people might like checking out my shop, The Urban Shaman, urbanshaman.net, which specializes in plants like peyote, ayahuasca, things like that.
And if you could... give one idea that you would like the listeners to go away with and hold on to, what would that be?
You know, the future's in your hands. Get active and take part in the world and make it into the Eden and paradise that you wish to see.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on, Chris. I appreciate your time, and good luck with your new book and all of your other projects.
Hey, thanks. I'll send you a copy. We'll do another interview after, if you had a chance to critique it.
All right. I would love to do that.
Okay. Cheers, brother. Take care.
All right. You too.
And that concludes podcast number 15. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next week, I think I'm going to do something a little bit different to take a break. I'm going to put out that John Loftus interview that I've been talking about for so long. I'm also going to throw some other stuff in with it that I've been gathering over the last month or two that I think will be quite appropriate. And on top of that, it will give me a break so that I can rest and heal before scrambling and pushing myself too hard to get out the next recorded shows. After that, we should have Ernest Werner, Judith Ann Brown, Professor Tom Roberts, Professor Michael Winkelman, and several other guests that I've mentioned as well. And anyway, hope you enjoyed the show. Until next time.